The headlines: the Syrian President Bashar al-Assad takes the oath of office following his re-election in the country's presidential vote in May. U.S. media reports say that Washington is sending a large number of its new stealth combat jets to the Pacific amid rising tensions with China. Also in the headlines, representatives of the Afghan government and the Taliban hold a new round of peace talks in the Qatari capital, Doha. This is Muse. Thanks for joining us. The Syrian President Bashar al-Assad has been sworn in for another 7-year term after winning the May election. Assad took the oath of office for the fourth time during an official ceremony at the presidential palace in Damascus. In an address, Assad hailed Syrian people for their resistance and ethical values, as well as their efforts to preserve national unity and integrity against the enemy's plots. He said that Syria would not be divided, adding that all bargains against his country have failed. Assad won the presidential election with a landslide in May, securing more than 95% of the votes cast. This was his second victory since the foreign-back insurgency, which engulfed the Arab country in 2011. Let's cross on over now and talk to our correspondent, Muhammad Ali, who joins us from Syria's capital, Damascus. Muhammad Ali, obviously it's a big achievement for the Syrian president to be sworn in amidst all of the challenges that the country is facing. Tell us some of the highlights of his speech and the way that the Syrians have received this.
Yes, of course. It's not just a constitutional oath that the president took this morning, but also it's a show of victory to the entire world, especially those countries who stood against Syria and tried to defeat the Syrian army and topple the Syrian president, Bashar al-Assad. Of course, this morning, the Syrian president, Bashar al-Assad, took the constitutional oath after winning the presidential election. He is now the president of the Syrian Arab Republic for the next 7 years. In his speech before the audience over there, especially, of course, we're speaking here about the People's Assembly, we're speaking about all walks of life, Syrians. President Assad started by praising Syrian awareness, especially during this war. He also stressed and called, and renewed his call, actually, on all Syrians who left the country, even those who stood against the country. He called on them to return back home. And he also highlighted the importance of the next period in the economic sector in Syria. He said that work will be focused on renewable energy and investment in the country. As you know, we are in a very difficult situation, in Syria, economic situation, in light of the destruction that happened by foreign-backed terrorism, also in light of the economic sanctions by the United States and the West, those sanctions that have made the Syrian daily lives much more difficult and made it almost impossible for the Syrian government to import the basic needs for the Syrians every day. So definitely the most important priority for the Syrian, for the Syrian president and for the government currently will be the economic situation.
If you can tell us a little bit more about the economic aspect or portion of his speech, because I believe that that's really important for Syrians in order for Syria to start rebuilding itself. He did talk a lot about factories, employment, spurring the economy. Does he foresee things like that happening, hopefully at an accelerated pace at this point?
Well, definitely. Even when the Syrian president was campaigning before the elections happened, the recent presidential elections, he was focusing on local work, meaning he was focusing on the agricultural sector, on the industrial sector, on reopening all of the factories that were affected by the war in various parts of the country. So all the focus will be now on inside Syria, not on the outside like before the war. The agricultural sector, the investment sector, he will also be giving investments, definitely Syria will be giving investments for its allies that sit with it, for example, Iran, Russia, and China. And by the way, I am now at the foreign ministry in Damascus over here, where Syria's foreign minister, Faisal Maqdad, is holding a meeting just inside with his Chinese counterparts in the first visit of his kind for China. And China, according to reports, is looking forward to make some investments, big investments in Syria. This is just one step of many that perhaps we'll be seeing in the future. So definitely, the president, President Bashar al-Assad and the Syrian government will be relying on the agricultural sector, the industrial sector, on businesses inside the country, also on cooperation with its allies.
Thank you so much for that, Muhammad Ali. We do appreciate that. Let's Continuing with the news, the U.S. Air Force is sending dozens of F-22 fighter jets to the Pacific amid growing tensions with China. The U.S. media say that the country is deploying nearly 25 Raptors for an exercise in Guam and Tinian Islands this month. That accounts for 25% of all mission F-22 aircraft in the U.S. fleet. Military officials say the U.S. has never deployed this amount of combat warplanes in the Pacific Air Force's area of operation. They say the deployment will send an immediate message to China, especially at a time when the two countries are at odds over a variety of issues, including Taiwan and the South China Sea. Commentator Kindo Ju says that the U.S. military deployment to the Pacific is the continuation of its policies to militarize the region, which is economically the most dynamic now.
If you look at the U.S. strategy, you know, back to the Obama period, there was this pivot to Asia strategy. Part of that strategy is to redeploy 60% of the U.S. air and the naval force in the Asia-Pacific region. And the recent development of the F-20s, F-22, obviously, dozens of them, is the continuation of that strategy. So obviously, the U.S. is investing heavily and deepening that strategy, in a sense, to militarize the entire region here. You know, if you look at the region, this is the most dynamic region in the world in terms of economic growth. So, you know, folks in Washington, they are in this mood that they need to do something to contain China.
Representatives of the Afghan government and the Taliban have launched fresh peace talks in the Qatari capital, Doha. Several high-ranking officials, including the former President Hamid Karzai and the head of the High Council for National Reconciliation, Abdullah Abdullah, are attending the negotiations. The spokesman for the government's negotiating team said that Kabul expects the negotiators to make headway with the talks in a short time and to reach a result. He expressed hope that the talks will lead to a lasting peace in the country. The negotiations come as Taliban militants have stepped up their attacks on cities and villages and have captured large parts of the territory. The Afghan military has been engaged in fierce fighting with the militants in some areas to try and retake control of the regions, including a southern border crossing with Pakistan. The death toll from devastating floods in Western Europe has climbed to 153 amid a rescue operation to save hundreds of more people still trapped or missing. Germany is the worst hit country, where police say that 133 people have so far died as a result of the disaster. The flooding caused by heavy rain has also killed 20 in Belgium. Troops and firefighters are searching for dozens of people believed to be missing in Germany. The deluge has also submerged homes in Luxembourg and the Netherlands. The cost of damage in Europe's worst floods in decades is estimated to be at several billion euros. Efforts are underway to restore gas, electricity, and telephone services. Sydney has introduced new restrictive measures as COVID-19 cases keep rising in the Australian city. Authorities have ordered a shutdown of buildings, non-essential businesses, and threatened fines for employers who force staff to come to work. They've also barred hundreds of thousands of people in the western suburbs from leaving their neighborhoods. The restrictions come as a citywide lockdown enters their fourth week. More than 1,000 people have tested positive in Sydney since the lockdown took effect. The city added 111 new cases over the past 24 hours. It's time now for the news review of this bulletin. The European High Court of Justice has ruled in favor of European businesses who want to sack employees for wearing religious clothing in front of customers. Although the court did say that the ban was meant to be implemented fairly and neutrally, many predict that it will be unfairly used to target Muslim women, many of them who wear the hijab or niqab. Rob Carter has more from London.
Shock has rippled through the Muslim community after the European Union's highest court ruled that businesses can sack Muslim women for wearing the hijab if they work face-to-face with customers or if the wearing of the religious clothing causes workspace conflicts. The ruling was in response to a case brought by two German Muslim female workers who were asked by their employers not to wear Islamic headscarves while at work.
The decision has been met by claims that it will further fuel Islamophobia at this crucial time when countries in Europe such as France and Austria are already eliminating freedoms for Muslims, supposedly to combat extremism.
In Britain, several religious MPs, including Muslims and a Sikh, chastised the court, labelling the ruling as Islamophobic and deeply flawed. In addition, I spoke with a London-based female Muslim media personality about her fears for the future of Muslims in Europe.
To me, I feel oppressed, to be honest, by this decision. And I feel that I am now limited in my identity and my freedom of rights, freedom of belief, all the values that are actually supposedly meant to be Western, modern. Yes, part of it is a symbol of my faith, but it's so much more if you were to really understand what the hijab actually means, or any sort of religious symbol. It is not just coming from one aspect. I think it's really unfair. And it's, again, it is targeting a particular group, especially the Muslim women, because we are the ones that are known to be wearing the headscarf known as the hijab.
Many activists warned that following the niqab ban, European powers would target the hijab next. They were right. But if the battle to protect the hijab is lost, what comes next? Robert Carter, London.
Let's discuss this a little further. Mustafa Traore is an academic and founder at an open agency, .org, who joins us from Paris. We also have Barry Grossman, who's an international lawyer, joining us from Bali. Okay, welcome to you both. Barry Grossman, let me first start with you. Well, obviously, this is going to lead to the obvious, which is that they're going to go for people who wear the hijab who are Muslim. I'm assuming that that's where this would be going. Why would the European High Court of Justice feel like this is a necessity here?
Well, look, it's very difficult to second-guess to think of the judges who made this decision. As your introductory piece commented, it certainly is deeply flawed. We can get into a technical discussion of things that doesn't really help. A starting point would be to take note that the court has essentially proceeded on the assumption that the U.S. Supreme Court decision of Citizens United applies in Europe as well, namely that corporations like individuals have rights. So we have a situation where ordinary people, human beings, have fought for many, many centuries to get certain basic and fundamental rights recognized, only to see corporations come along very late in the day and lay a claim to having those same rights. And then we come to a balancing of those rights, and now we have the court saying that while individuals have a right to freedom of expression and the like, companies, employers, are entitled to essentially make determinations that involve firing people for their religious convictions in order to appear neutral before an ever increasingly reactionary and bigoted public, and to prevent the so-called social disputes. Now, they say apply it evenly, but the fact of the matter is, there's very little left in Christianity that requires anyone to do anything. And I doubt anyway that this will be applied equally. This clearly targets Muslims, and in particular targets Muslim women wearing hijab, having already won the day with restrictions on the ability to wear niqab. This is nobody's business but the person who chooses to wear those items of clothing. And while there may have been an argument based on security when it comes to niqab, even that was rather thin, this is not what this is about. This is straight out pandering by the court to the court of public opinion and an increasingly reactionary and extremist element in the public that would like to see all Muslims sent packing back to where they feel that they came from. And it's entirely unacceptable. Nothing good can come of this. It's deeply flawed, makes all sorts of assumptions that can't be justified and weren't even addressed.
So, Mustafa Traore, based on what Barry Grossman has said and based on what it appears, do you think that Muslims are being targeted through this ruling?
Well, I think, yes, that Muslims are targeted by this ruling. So I was saying that, yes, I think that Muslims are targeted by this ruling. And so we must not be surprised. What I think we have to do, we have to abide by the law. This is the European law, and we have to respect it. We've got also to understand that Britain, which was much more in favor of a system
of multiculturalism is not really part of the EU anymore. So things are going to change. If you look at the strong countries within the EU, you have France and Germany. So the deal now is different, and this is something that we have to take into consideration. There is this this will from many Europeans to assimilate the newcomers, the Muslims. They are perceived as newcomers, and their religion, Islam, is also perceived as not a European religion, but more a religion that was brought by the migrants. So we have to respect and fight with the tools we are given within the European Union, but there's no other thing that we can do. We have to accept it. Of course, I think, this is my personal opinion, that Islam is targeted, okay, and that things are going to be different now that that Britain is not part of the EU, that England is not part of the EU, and we have no other choice than to follow and to abide by the law.
Thank you very much for that. That's Barry Grossman, international lawyer from Bali. Musa Ochayori, thank you. Academic and founder at anopeneye.org from Paris there. Many thanks to both of you. And with that, we come to an end for this news review. That's all the time we have for this edition of World News. So bye-bye for now.
This is IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
Aperture.
Being the second largest country in the Middle East, Iran is rich with a colorful bouquet of architectural masterpieces, magnificent mosques, ancient caravanserais, impressive rock tombs, and former royal cities of the ancient Persian Empire. But perhaps Iran's amazing desert landscape has been largely overlooked. I'm Zarin Shajeri, and this is Aperture. Iran's deserts are unique in the variety of their composition and surface types. A yardang, or kalut as they're called in Farsi, is a topographical feature that has been carved out of a surface by the wind. They're most commonly found in deserts where there is a sand supply, which abrades the surface when moved by the wind, and soft sedimentary rocks that the sand easily erodes. Over time, the sand wears down the surface into beautiful streamlined shapes that are aligned with the prevailing sand-moving winds. Iran is famous for mega yardangs in Kerman in the south of the country. Stay with us for this episode of Iran Trotter as we follow Javad to discover the spectacular kaluts in Iran.
To most humans, nature means trees, jungles, rivers, and mountains. But is that all there is to this beautiful nature created by the architect of all beauties? God is limitless. He is infinite and has created nature with infinite beauties. Nature has many and varied, complicated aspects, and the natural world in Iran is no exception. Many people do not consider deserts and wastelands as part of nature. But the fact is, deserts constitute a large part of the environment on our planet. All we have to do is open our eyes and look at these countless, peerless beauties. I'm Javad Gharai. I'm an Iran trotter, and I'm traveling to the most pristine areas of my beloved country and uncovering to you its many beauties. This time, I've come to a vast city in Kerman province, a city that in fact forms a major swath of the amazing landscape in Kerman. The fictitious city of Kaluts. I set out on a 110-kilometer walking journey to the northeast of Kerman province to arrive at my main destination. The Yardangs are located in an area spanning 11,000 square kilometers in the west of Iran's Lut Desert. The Yardangs of Lut cover an area around 150 kilometers long and around 70 kilometers wide. In the words of some researchers, this vast expanse used to be the bed of a lake sometime in the third geological period, and that in fact the Yardangs, or the Kaluts, are made up of brittle sediments lying at the bottom of that lake. At some point in the third geological period, the lake dried up as a result of the major climatic changes that occurred on Earth. Torrential rains and their ensuing humidity in the following periods and water erosion led to the creation of the kaluts, or yardangs. Other researchers believe the yardangs are the result of the alluvial deposits originating from Birjan Mountains in the distant past. Sharp temperature fluctuations in the Lut and the constant blowing of local winds carrying abrasive sediment loads of sandstones battering these yardangs over the years have led to their erosion. Winds that continue to lash out at these yardangs and eventually raise beautiful clay terraces to the ground. Trips to the heart of deserts and wastelands have always been risky, but studying up on such places and the risks involved in traveling to them, not to mention carrying a proper map, a GPS device, and the topographic map of the area you are traveling to, can bring the number of risks involved down to a great extent. In all fairness, one of the most beautiful areas in the Lut Desert is the Shahdad Yardangs of Kerman. I mean, there are few places in the world with such beautiful desert landscape. I think nowhere in the world can you find a landscape as vast as this one. Here I am in the Lut Yardangs, hoping for a good trip, and I'm positive it's gonna be a thrill. I stepped onto a part of the river that not many people were interested in traveling to for several reasons. The flight distance between the Yardangs and the Yalan Megadunes in the west of Lut is around 150 kilometers. For several consecutive years, part of the Yalan Megadunes was announced by NASA as one of the hottest spots on Earth. This is an area where temperatures run above 70 degrees in the summer. With no trace of life among them, the Yardangs of Lut look scary to human eyes. Although in recent years, some researchers have discovered and registered a number of plants and insect species in them. But at first look, the fictional town of Kalutz or Yardangs bears no trace of life of any kind. Encountering sandstorms in the desert or getting lost in them, or all the other hidden dangers of such terrains, can put your life at grave risk. But none of those reasons stop me from walking right into the Yardangs. You can enjoy spending time in this beautiful natural landscape with enough information on its climate and terrain, and by using a map and GPS device. No one has found any trace of human habitation in the Kalutz area. Not in the past and not in the present eras. But on the outskirts of these beautiful Kalutz, there are many remnants of human habitation from years gone by. The Kalutz are located on the outskirts of Shahdad, a city in Kerman that is among the most ancient in Iran, a place with a more than 6,000-year-old culture and history. The world's oldest metal flag was discovered here. The many kanats and water reservoirs on the outskirts of the Kalutz, as well as the lush gardens of Shahdad, are evidence of human settlement in the distant past. Right at the beginning of the route, I came across an area with a concentration of strange Kalut formations, a place famous for its egg-shaped hills. I have to walk a long distance to get to the heart of the Shahdad Kalutz, but the beautiful elevations you see behind me, which is sort of the prelude to the main Kalutz, are called the egg-shaped hills, and for good reason. They really do look like eggs, although these hills are considered as little Kalutz. The reason they've been abraded more than the other Kalutz in this region is rainfalls and, of course, the type of soil they are made from. And if it goes on like this, rainwater and wind are going to destroy them in the not-too-distant future. Every spot you go to in this region, you see new and different Kalutz or Yardangs. The majority of those who travel to the Kalutz are not aware of the diversity of the landscapes in this terrain. and its natural phenomena. But the fact is, the Kalutz of Kerman are a peerless kaleidoscope of beautiful desert landscapes. Everywhere you look in this region, you see spectacular yet peculiar sights. Around 7 kilometers after the egg-shaped hills, I arrived at another strange yet interesting scenery. From a distance, I thought I was approaching some prehistoric cemetery. But well, this is not a cemetery. These mounds you see here are called the Dolphin Hills. In fact, they are very small kalutz in the vicinity of the big ones. The dual action of wind abrasion and rainwater has chiseled them to look like dolphins swimming on a wave of dust and sand. Every part of the kalutz in Shahdad has its own unique shape. And these Dolphin Hills are among those unique parts of the Shahdad Kalutz. These are really extraordinary, really beautiful. I've been walking around in the Shahdad Kalutz for hours now, deep into the heart of these remarkable protuberances. Although it is fall now, and the best season to travel to the Lut Desert, and of course to the Shahdad Kalutz, early spring is also a good time. Anyway, it's noontime and very hot. It was very cold in the morning, but now the temperature keeps going up, so I'm going to have to take a layer off. The temperature in the desert fluctuates sharply between the morning and the evening. It's always like that. So you have to remember to pack the right clothes for summer and winter weather. That's what it's like in the desert. You get summer and winter weather at the same time, happening within hours of each other on a single day. You should keep that in mind. It's really getting hot here. I just hope it'll stop right there as we approach noontime. Because, I mean, the sun, the heat from the sun can just be unbearable. Although I've already thought of something for a situation like this, one of the most important things we have to carry with us when traveling through deserts and wastelands are glasses, sunglasses that is. They're very important to protecting your eyes against the scorching sun. When the rays of the sun reach the dirt, they are reflected in your direction and bother your eyes. The air here is very clean. That's why there's so much light. So you have to wear sunglasses if you ever come to a place like this. If you don't, your vision is going to get hurt, and you're going to get wrinkles around your eyes. And that's what the ladies are very sensitive about. Dazzling beauties of the Kalutz redoubled my enthusiasm for traveling into the heart of these sand formations. But the deeper I walked into them, the more arduous things became. Walking on the sand in the punishing heat requires strenuous effort and drains your energy. The day started out cold, but the temperatures kept going up as I approached midday. The biting autumn cold was nowhere to be felt. Walking on the sand and grit really wears you out after a while. And it makes you sweat a lot, too. It's starting to get really hot. I'd better change into something more suitable. I'm wearing a thin layer, but the short sleeves expose my forearms to the sun, and that means sunburn. The sun is just bearing down on me. I feel like it's burning my face. I mean, I really had to change my clothes to avoid getting sunburn on my arms. The sun can get really annoying round about noontime out in the desert, even if it's not very hot. You're bound to get sunburned. So you must wear long-sleeved shirts with good breathability at the same time. I mean, that's what I always do. And I've never run into any problems because long sleeves have always protected my arms against the sun. Now, more important than wearing long-sleeved shirts out in the desert is to have proper headgear, such as this hat. What this hat does is it prevents the radiation from the sun from reaching your head to a great extent. And as a result, your face, neck, and ears won't get burnt. It really feels good when you wear one of these. And of course, a good pair of sunglasses is a must-have in a place like this. But there is another type of glasses, sunglasses, that I carry with me all the time. These are called storm goggles by some and skiing goggles by others. It's important to pack a pair of these goggles, too, because when there is a sandstorm, when strong winds start blowing, they kick up a lot of sand and other particles into the air, and the goggles prevent them from going into your eyes. More important than that, you can see where you're going when you're out in the sticks without worrying about sand getting into your eyes. Man, I'm beat. It really wears you out when you walk on sand and up and down on those little hills. It's just fatiguing. I dare say, walking about in the Kalutz area and the hot areas of Lut Desert in the summer is next to impossible. The temperatures are so high and the surface of the earth so hot, you won't last more than a few kilometers. That's a time when you cannot see any living creatures in the Lut Desert. You can only see them during the night. It's very important to carry enough water when you travel to a place like this. If you're going to spend 2, 3, or 4 days trekking in the desert, make sure you have enough water. That's because you sweat a lot and your body loses a lot of water. And obviously, when that happens, you become dehydrated. In addition to that, you have to eat food that contains salt. But if your food doesn't contain enough salt, you need to eat salty nuts. That's because your body loses a lot of sodium as you sweat in the heat, and that's going to harm your body. Okay, now let's eat an orange. The Kalutz expand intermittently from the west of the Lut Desert towards the southeast. The corridors formed among them look in the same direction as the Kalutz themselves, that is, in the direction of the local winds. They are all very brittle. The shape of each Kalut depends on how it was first formed, its density, and the direction of the winds that brush against it on their paths. Shifting winds and other erosive factors in the Kalutz basin has created a variety of them with different shapes and sizes. In some places, winds have filled the depression around the Kalutz with sand, and in other places, they have blown away the sand from around them. Now, let's take a look at the etymology of the word Kalut. Kalut is a blend of two words, Kal and Lut. Together, they mean the city of Lut. In the Khorasan region, in central Iran, and along the coast of the Caspian Sea, the word Kal has taken on different meanings. In Khorasan and Sistan and Baluchistan, it's the root of words such as Kalate and Kalat, meaning castle or citadel. It could also mean a hamlet or a village perched on an elevation. In the center of Iran, the word Kalat means a walled-off village. The Kaluts are an imaginary city. From a distance, they look like the remains of a ruined city. Of course, there are a few other areas like this in some parts of the world, but the Kalutz of Iran cover the largest such area in the world. Without human interference and technology, Mother Nature has put on display her unique artistic talent and creativity. It was starting to get dark when, on a nature trip, it's important that the nature traveler find the right spot where they can pitch their tent before the dark sets in. That will ensure a good night's rest without any trouble. I'm going to call it a day now, and I think the best place for me to camp out is right here next to a lone kalut surrounded by sand. The wind has created this hole here as if to prepare it for someone to set up their tent in. This is perfect because here I'll have my back to the wind, which usually blows from the heights of Siuj Mountains back there towards the kaluts. I mean, that's why this hole has been created. This kalut hasn't allowed sand to accumulate here, hence the evenly shaped depression around it. It's just the perfect place to camp out. We're spending the night here. It's a great spot, and hopefully we're going to have a star-studded sky above us. Okay, I've been told I wouldn't be able to find any firewood or shrubs or any living creatures because deep in the heart of the kaluts, the winds are so strong, they won't allow any vegetation to grow on their path. In other words, if a plant grows here, it gets blown away by the wind. But there is an exception to that rule, and that is an area located on the path of floodwaters flowing down to the kaluts area from the Ravar Mountains. The floods uproot the shrubs on the banks of the rivers nearby, the ones near the kaluts, that is, and dump them in the seasonal river that's created near here and eventually brings them over to the kaluts area. I might be able to find something there to make a fire here tonight to keep me and others warm. The temperatures in the Lut Desert fluctuate constantly, making life a bit difficult for nature travelers. Therefore, I always pack warm clothes and a good warm sleeping bag. Another beauty of the desert is its star-studded night sky. In the absence of light pollution, you get a clear view of the twinkling stars and part of the Milky Way. You can spend hours feasting your eyes on those beautiful celestial bodies that adorn the expansive firmament above. I'm glad I found these sticks. It gets really cold out here at night. I rarely make fire during my trips because I set a lot of store by nature and even dry sticks of wood. These sticks are a form of energy. They are no different than oil and gas, so we shouldn't use them recklessly. As I say, I don't make fire when I camp out unless I really have to. Most of the time, I don't need to, and when I do, I make a small one. But in the Lut Desert and in the Shahdad Desert, temperatures fluctuate a lot. I remember coming here 3 years ago. One night, winter was about to come to an end. I mean, like 2 or 3 days to the end of the season, 3 years ago. That night, right here in the Lut Desert, the temperature plunged to -1 degrees. Here's the thing. In the day, at midday I mean, I had traveled deeper into this area and experienced temperatures as high as 43 degrees. That's a huge difference in one single day. It was all very strange to me. But well, that's what deserts are like. It's typical of them. It can get really cold during the night, especially during fall and winter. Therefore, you have to have proper clothes to wear, and if you manage to find a few sticks, you can keep yourself warm and enjoy yourself sitting around a campfire.
This for is a better life.
For a better life.
فرمود بعثت لأتمم مكارم الأخلاق.
The Holy Prophet of Islam says, I have been sent to complete noble manners.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. السلام عليكم, brothers and sisters. You are listening to IRIB English Radio, and here is Batul. Welcome to the program for a better life. In our previous sessions, we asked this question, that what is a better life? Then we came to the conclusion that a better life is when a person is happy. Now, this happiness is not the material happiness. It is the happiness of the soul. So how can I reach this happiness? The answer is when I become a better person. Therefore, to have a better life, I need to be a better person first. In the very, very first session, we said that the first step to become a better person is yaghda, which is to wake up. Now, wake up from what? Wake up from my deep sleep of negligence. Wake up from ghafla. Now, what is it that makes me ghafil? What is it that makes me negligent? What is it that stops me from becoming a better person? Ayatollah Jawadi Amali says that one of the main causes of ghafla are the uninvited thoughts, memories, something that enters. Thoughts that enter our mind, thoughts that pierce our mind, thoughts that are deep-rooted. We have no control over them. They flash back without our control. That is why he calls them uninvited. Therefore, it is said that we should be very careful with what we watch at night, as it stays in our thoughts till morning. For example, I watch a movie in the night. I will be dreaming about it till morning. Sometimes I'm the hero in the movie chasing the villain, or sometimes I'm trying to change the plot of the movie in my dreams. So now let me explain the term uninvited thoughts a little deeper by opening up a discussion. Brothers and sisters, when we start something new, we are not an expert on it. In the beginning, we find it difficult because we are not used to it. But as time goes by, with practice, we become an expert on it. For example, when we start driving, we are taking driving lessons, we find it very stressful. Our hands are grabbing the steering wheel, our foot is always covering the brake. We are constantly watching in the rear view mirror. Our eyes are glued to the road in front of us. This is the beginning of the driving. We avoid talking to anyone. When our kids ask for something from the back seat, we tell them, please don't disturb mama, she's driving right now. But as time passes by, with practice, the same driving becomes a piece of cake for us. We drive with one hand, we talk, we laugh, we even open the water bottles with one hand and pass it in the back seat to our kids. We are all relaxed. Why? Because now we have become an expert in driving.
We were given so many prizes. We changed the desert into oases. We built buildings of different lengths and sizes, and we felt so very satisfied. We bought and bought and couldn't stop buying. We gave charity to the poor cause we couldn't stand the crying. We thought we paid our dues, but in fact to ourselves we're just lying. Oh, I'm walking with my head lowered in shame for my place. I'm walking with my head lowered for my race. Yes, it's easy to blame everything on the West, when in fact our focus should be on ourselves. I'm walking with my head lowered in shame for my place. I'm walking with my head lowered for my race. Yes, it's easy to blame everything on the West, when in fact our focus should be on ourselves. Is it satisfied? Is Allah satisfied? Is Allah satisfied?
Our prophets were also an expert on doing good deeds. It was not because they were forced to be good people. It was because they trained themselves to be good. Allah said about our Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi in Surah A'la, وَنُيَسِّرُكَ لِلْيُسْرَى, and we make your way smooth to a state of ease. It means that Allah told our Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi, you have made it easy for good deeds. It does not mean that the good deeds have been made easy for you. Similarly, Musa alayhi salam asks Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in Surah Taha, وَيَسِّرْلِي أَمْرِي, make my affair easy for me. So, this teaches that man should be such that he should be able to do good with ease, not that the good deeds should become easy for him. In short, the verses mean that the prophets were such pure beings that good deeds flowed from them. The same quality is seen in the Ahlul Bayt, who did good without hesitation. Whereas it is very difficult for others to give away from theirs, to sacrifice, to give away from their belongings, from their table. But the Ahlul Bayt did this easily. Surah Insan talks about it. وَيُطْعِمُونَ الطَّعَامَ عَلَىٰ حُبِّهِ مِسْكِينًا وَيَتِيمًا وَأَسِيرًا. They give food for the love of him, for the love of Allah. To whom? To the needy, the orphan, and the prisoner. The same applies with the man's development, brothers and sisters. In the beginning, performing good deeds is difficult. Then the more he keeps doing it, it becomes normal for him. And then with more effort added to it, it becomes natural to him. He becomes an expert. Now going back to our discussion, uninvited thoughts are also the same. In the beginning, it starts with what we hear, with what we see, with what we said, participating in a certain gathering, reading something, watching a movie, or playing a video game. With the passage of time, these thoughts are pictured in our mind. Then they are stacked one over the other until they become too many. Later, these thoughts pop up in our mind without control. They become a part of us. They crowd our mind. They overtake it completely to the extent that they make us negligent of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. So brothers and sisters, when the mind is occupied by anything but Allah, it makes us ghafil. It makes us negligent. It keeps us away from becoming a better person. It takes us astray from having a better life. So let us pray to Allah that our thoughts are occupied only with the remembrance of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. That there is nothing in our thoughts but Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. وآخر الدعواهم أن الحمد لله رب العالمين.
Your mercy, your love is on me. So on me. So on me. So on me.
To be all I can be, and I know that you see how much you need to.
love is all I need.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.